Okay. So, tonight's supposed to be history night. Right? Monday night? Except to say, I switched, so it's Tuesday night. I want to speak a little bit about the structure of the Talmud in general tonight, which is the Mishnah. The Talmud is made up of two parts, Mishnah and Gemara. The Mishnah was written by Mishnah was not written, but it was edited by the people we call Tanoim, and they are the ones who lived roughly from the beginning of the Second Temple era to the time of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who was around the year 200. And then we have the period of the Amoraim, who wrote the Gemara. The Gemara began around the year 200, was finally compiled around the year 500. Okay, so those are the time frames we're dealing with. Now, there are two Gemaras. There's the Bavli and Yerushalmi. The Bavli was a Babylonian Talmud, was created around the year 500. The Jerusalem Talmud, which is nice to do actually with Jerusalem, it was written in Tiberias, was completed around the year 350 or so. And that is nice. They didn't want to complete it, either one of them, but the persecutions became so great in each of these respective locations that the period of great geniuses came to an end. And therefore it came to an end earlier in Israel and later in Babel.
Were they created independently of one another?
They're created independently. There is a common perception, which is stated by great Rishonim, by great scholars of, let's say, the 900s, 1000s, that the Babylonians had access to the they had access to it. But it seems that they didn't have full access, because there's a lot of stuff in Yerushalmi which should have been brought down in the Bavli. So even if they had access, it wasn't complete. Okay. So there are certainly overlaps, many overlaps, but there are many things also which are separate and different. The Yerushalmi is much more fun than learning Bavli. And the reason for that is because in Bavli, there were commentaries written throughout the years, beginning with the Gaonim, a short amount of time after the Talmud was after the Talmud was, this is, we're talking about the history of the Talmud. So there were many different commentaries written on the Bavli, beginning of the period of the Gaonim, which came shortly after the end of the Talmudic period, and therefore we feel that we are obligated to follow their interpretations, because they were very big authorities and they said good stuff. So we don't feel that we have the capacity to have a better understanding than they did. Also, they carefully sifted through the different versions of the text and came out with a version which they felt was the best one. In fact, Rashi is the major commentary on the Gemara. He says, Hagi Garcinan, this is the way to read the Gemara. And in fact, the Gemara in front of us reads exactly like Rashi says it does. Because the edits, the publishers of the Bavli, as time went by, when they were looking to make the text precise, so they just looked at Rashi. Whatever the Lord Rashi said, and fixed the text in the Gemara accordingly. Sometimes Tosfos, which is on the other side of the page, will bring down the other version which existed. But our Gemara almost always, 95% of the time, follows what Rashi did. Okay, how Rashi structured the text. In Yerushalmi, there are no commentaries, no major commentaries, until the 1700s. The Rishonim didn't learn Yerushalmi, except they used it as a reference book, but they didn't actually learn it. I shouldn't say that. They might have learned it and not written commentaries on it, but the way they use it is as a reference book as opposed to a book of, a Talmud. I think the way we say this is because most of our halacha comes from the Bavli. So they were studying Gemara in order to derive halacha, so most of it is from the Bavli. But if you bear in mind, the Rishonim, a lot of them didn't study, they didn't write compositions on anything more than a few mesechtas each, right? So therefore, it's understandable that they might have not have gotten around to the Bavli. Moreover, in the old days when manuscripts were rare and difficult to find, so what are you going to invest in first? A Babli manuscript or a Yerushalmi manuscript? A Babli, because it's more authoritative, because it lasted longer, and they had access at least to part of the Yerushalmi, so therefore, Babli was the main area of study. Nowadays, when everything is printed, so it's not a problem. So, since that's the case, the Yerushalmi's text was never actually etched in stone. So you can go in the year 2007 and suggest an alternative reading in the text of the Yerushalmi. And that is so much more fun, because you can't tamper with the text in the Bavli, but you can tamper with the text in the Yerushalmi. You yourself, yes. Moreover, since the earliest consistent commentaries were in the 1700s, you don't have to accept what they say. You can just reject it out of hand. Because we have a general principle, you can't argue on a Rishon. Now, what a Rishon is exactly, we don't know precisely, but generally, we assume by the time the invention of the printing press, the period of the Rishonim is over, which is in late 1400s. So by that, so we don't argue generally on anybody who came before the 1400s, and usually we don't argue on anybody in the 1500s either. But we can argue with people in the 1700s. We have that capacity still to do so. So therefore, you don't have to accept what they're saying. You can offer your own alternative, which is also a lot of fun.
Like whom?
What?
After 1700, like whom?
What do you mean?
I mean, who are those after 1700?
On the Yerushalmi, there are two commentaries called the Korban Eida and the Pnei Moshe. The Korban Eida was written by the rabbi in Berlin in the mid to late 1700s, and the Pnei Moshe was written by the Vilna Gaon's Rebbe, the rabbi of the Vilna Gaon in the early 1700s. But if you have, generally speaking, any sefer, any book which is published, not you and me, right? I'm talking about great rabbis, right? But if any sefer published after the year 1700 is subject to review, because there was no universal acceptance by the Jewish people of a cutoff date for the period of the Achronim, of the late authorities, beginning in the 1500s. We don't know exactly how it came about, but somehow there became a universal cutoff date for the Rishonim. Whereas everybody agreed, there became no explicit agreement ever happened, but implicit, there became an understanding which developed that, okay, we don't argue Rishonim anymore. So therefore, from that period on, backwards, we don't argue. From that period on forwards, we do still argue. So that's, the borders are not precise, because you know, it's around the time of printing press. The period of the Rishonim also lasted longer in Sephardic countries than Ashkenazic countries, because the Sephardim still had great geniuses when the Ashkenazim no longer had the same level of scholarship. So different countries, different people have different qualities. But generally speaking, we don't argue on Rishonim, and the Rishonim themselves don't argue on the Gemara. Nobody argues on the Gemara, because the Gemara was also, we don't know exactly when and where, and if this happened at one time or just became over time, it was accepted as universal text, basic Jewish law, which nobody can undermine.
Like Rambam, Mechaber, these are Rishonim?
Yeah, the Mechaber is a matter of dispute. Some people regard the Mechaber as a Rishon, some don't. Because he was very late. He was in the mid-1500s.
I have a question. How come these Acharonim or Rishonim, they go and they say Halakha against the Gaoni or different generation? Because right now we have a lot of problems regarding about the halakha. We don't know which one we go. Whatever we go, some say you can go, some say you cannot go. In this between, there are a lot of conflictions, you know?
Yes.
So how come they, for example, in Mechaber, as my rabbi told me, in Halakha says that if you want, you can go with my halacha. If you have your minhag, you can continue with your minhag. So how come they come and they make a halacha?
Who's they?
For example, Mechaber.
The way the Mechaber works is like this. The Mechaber, by the way, the Mechaber is the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch is the background set over there. So it comes in many shapes and colors, well, with the white stickers on the spine. So that is the basic text of Jewish law, the most successful one written over time. Right? Because the Rambam wrote a code of Jewish law, wasn't successful.
As far as
Klal Yisrael abiding by his halachic standards. Right? Excuse me?
Why is that?
Because the Shulchan Aruch, later works superseded it. In other words, when the Shulchan Aruch was written, the Rambam became not practical halacha. Okay? The Shulchan Aruch remains practical halacha to this very day. The Rambam does not. More people learn Rambam than learn Shulchan Aruch because it's exciting to learn. But not because it's actual practical halacha. Also, the Rambam wrote in many more areas of Torah than the Shulchan Aruch, right? Shulchan Aruch is just about halachas which are relevant to us in our day and age. The Rambam is on the entire Torah, right? So it's a very, very different kind of work. But before the Rambam, there was the Baal Halachos Gedolos, who was one of time of the Gaoni. There was the Shiltos, the Rabbi Achaigon, also a Gaon. There was also the Rif and there was also the Rif and other Rishonim, right? So, after the Rambam, there was the Rosh, there was the Tur, who first wrote in the order of the Shulchan Aruch which we have today. The Tur was the Baal Tur, Yaakov Baal Tur. He has his commentary which appears in the Chumash. But that's his main claim to fame, is he actually organized the first Shulchan Aruch. It was according to the order which we have today, or Achaim, laws of daily life. Choshemishpat, monetary laws, Yoredea, laws of kashrus, and other sort of related areas, Eben Ezer, laws of marriage and divorce. So he's the one who initially made that division. The Mechaber, Rabbi Yosef Karo, wrote a commentary on the Torah called the Beis Yosef. He wrote a commentary on the Rambam called the Kesef Mishnah. And then he wrote his own Shulchan Aruch. And his Shulchan Aruch, he based on the three big guns. The three big guns are the Rambam, the Rif, and the Rosh. And when he paskin, he goes paskin like whatever the opinion of two out of three.
Why not the
Torah? What?
Why not the Torah?
The Torah, because the Torah is really reflects his father's positions, the Rosh's position. So it wasn't considered to be separate from the Rosh. Okay? So the Rambam lived in the 11th century, the 12th century, the Rif lived in the 11th century, and the Rosh lived in the 13th century. So these are all the people which took into account. Rav Moshe Itzelish, the Ramah, who wrote the Ashkenazic comments on the Shulchan Aruch, so he took into account other authorities which the Mechaber didn't take into account, because the Ashkenazim had not as great authorities, but their own authorities. Like you said before, where, like a minhag, even the Mechaber, even Rabbi Yosef Karo holds that a minhag can go against halacha, so certainly the Ashkenazim had their own minhagim already. That's where the Ramah wrote his comments on the Shulchan Aruch, giving the Ashkenazic standard of halacha. That became accepted by Klal Yisrael. We don't know how Klal Yisrael does these things. It's kind of mystical, right? But Klal Yisrael accepted Shulchan Aruch as the benchmark, as the code. This is what you have to follow. If a ger comes today, somebody comes to convert, we say to him, listen, you want to know what you have to do in Judaism? Shulchan Aruch. That's the standard. Now, the Rishonim never accepted the Gaonim as the final word. In other words, even though a Gaon might say something, and a Gaon was earlier than a Rishon, the Rishonim didn't feel that they had any restraint to argue on the Gaonim.
Why?
Because they felt they were just as smart.
I'm sorry, what?
They felt they were just as smart.
Why aren't they going there?
They were! They were!
What do you mean they were?
They were very smart, the Rishonim.
What?
They were very smart. They were as smart as the Gaonim.
No. Rishonim, they were smarter or Gaonim.
They were just as smart as each other.
Why are they different? Why are they different?
But in the time, whoever it comes...
It doesn't work that way. No. It doesn't work that way. Only...
We have it in Gemara.
No, we don't. In the Gemara, as a matter of fact, we usually pass in like the last authority, the latest. Because it's not true. Within periods, it's not true. Somebody at the end of a period can argue with somebody at the beginning of the period. It's just when you go to a new period, then you've gone past the cutoff date.
I don't understand this, because today, if we were to come and say something like, I think this rabbi is as smart as the Chofetz Chaim.
Right, so perhaps I think if Mashiach doesn't come soon, then you will see a cutoff date of the Holocaust. Because today, the Svarim which are written today, I mean, of course, there are going to be people who live, you know, at the border who are going to still be considered to be like they were earlier authorities, right? But you're going to say, because today, the level of scholarship in yeshivas is so amazingly low by standards of yesteryear that you will see a cutoff point at the time of the Holocaust. But it doesn't develop right away. In other words, it can only be seen retrospectively. Now, as you look backwards, you see, oh, this was a cutoff point. That was a cutoff point. It's not, you can't say, nobody got together, made a big assembly and said, okay, cutoff point, guys. They didn't do it.
But the original motion to question Chazal, though, the original motion, those are their stages. Those are their stages. They're going to
Rishonim,
then Gonim.
No,
Gonim Rishonim. Gonim Rishonim. So
do you know why the Gaonim are called the Gaonim?
Because they're geniuses.
No.
No.
You okay?
Oh, yeah.
The word Gaon actually means, in ancient usage, Rosh Yeshiva. Rosh Yeshiva was called the Gaon. There were two yeshivas in Babel. Two major yeshivas. What were they? Anybody know? Sura and Pumpadisa. The Rosh Yeshiva, those two yeshivas were called Gaonim. Gaon literally means proud. Gava is pride. So these were the pride of Judaism. As a matter of fact, there were a couple of small yeshivas, but their Rosh Yeshiva and any other scholar at the time technically was not called a Gaon. We call the period of the Gaonim, and we kind of freely dispensed the title Gaon to anybody who lived at that time. But if you lived at that time, you can only call yourself a Gaon if you were the Rosh Yeshiva of one of these two yeshivas. Okay? Now, also, they say that Gaon in Gematria is 60. You know, the corresponding 3 plus 1 plus 6 plus 50, because there's 60 Mesechtas in Mishnayos, Shas Mishnayos. So to be a Gaon, you have to know, well, 60, and that was, you know, the sign of genius. But in fact, they weren't all geniuses. They all had this position as Rosh Yeshiva. So therefore, they were all called Gaonim. But that's why there's no... Although now we say, okay, period of Gaonim came from the year 500 to the year 1000. Period of Rishonim, the year 900. It overlapped a little bit to the year 1500. But it's not that there was a significant quality difference between the Gaonim and the Rishonim. And therefore, the Rambam argues on the Gaonim.
So Achronim came in on the Rishon. Why wouldn't he have the liberty to do that?
And he can. We'd just be laughing at him.
So you're saying then, that's what I'm saying. Why would we laugh at him?
Because we know that he's a moron compared to the Rishonim.
We only know that in retrospect. So we could say, that Rishonim could come and say, the Rishonim who are arguing on the Gaonim are morons as well.
That's right. And that's why we have people like the Rugatrover, who's one of the greatest geniuses who ever lived, who was born in the town of Rogachev, was the Hasidic rabbi of the town of Dvinsk, city of Dvinsk, who died in the 1930s. He just ignored all the Achronim. He just jumped back to the Rishonim and passed it straight, and he basically ignored all the Rishonim too, except for the Rambam. And he passed, what? Because he liked the Rambam. And so he basically, when he passed in Halacha, he would just ignore everything in the meantime. He didn't put about the Shulchan Aruch, of course, and go back to the Rambam, the Gemara, Rambam, Paskin.
It seems to undermine everything I've learned, though, about respecting Chazal. Like, for today, I understand it, because we're not that level. But it seems like that needs to hold true for the respect of Chazal and tradition and the Torah.
What needs to hold true?
That you need to sort of take the opinion of those who came before you, at least acknowledge them, to just completely skip over the Akronim and say that there's almost, it's almost a statement of saying by the Rugged Shepherd doing that, that the Akronim are not, he's almost putting himself over.
Right, he was.
Right, so that seems to dismiss, I can't just go back and say,
you can't, and I can't, so what? What's bothering you?
Go to the door, like, okay, so let's say he, or any other gadol today, went and all of a sudden said, I'm not going to take any afro.
Mr. Brewer, I don't agree with that.
Right. I'm going to just listen to the Rishonim, that's it, or the Gaonim. People call him out because.
Right, okay. They take away his Gadol card.
Right.
Yeah.
How does
that Gadol card, ID. What?
I don't understand. So there's something to me that's...
But there's no... You see, there's no... That's the remarkable thing. There are no rules. There's no rule book which says to be a Gadol, you have to meet these criteria, right? And you can't argue on somebody you go back in. This book doesn't exist, right? So since there's no rule book, yes, if he wanted to come and do that, he could do it. But there's no, in our generation, if they argued on the Rambam, who we would hold in high esteem. We'd just start laughing at him.
So, no, the problem is this. We hold that those people, whoever was more in the bad, they are more stronger, they are more...
Not tired. By year, only by period. It might be that, in, let's say, in the 1500s, or let's say the 1400s, there were greater geniuses than in the 900s. It's hypothetically possible. Because there was no dramatic event. What happened? Why did the period of the Talmud end? Not because they decided, okay, let's take IQ tests. Let's see the IQ of this generation. Let's take IQ tests. Let's see the IQ of the next generation. Whoops, it went down like that. No, it's because since the such great persecutions occurred, so therefore, you know, there was in Babel and in Israel, there was great persecution. So as a result, the yeshivas broke up, scholarship, the learning suffered for quite some time, and after things got back again, they realized, you know, we lost a lot during that period. We can't hardly learn them anymore. That didn't happen between the Gaonim and the Rishonim. And that didn't happen until the Holocaust in the period of Acharonim. Right? So you need to have some sort of defining event in order to say, later on, retrospectively, it can be a positive event too, like you're writing a Shulchan Aruch. That's a classic example of a positive event. Christ saw a sort of Shulchan Aruch and said, after Shulchan Aruch, nobody can argue the Shulchan Aruch. Even that, there was a boundary period. Of course, you know, the commentaries on the side of the Shulchan Aruch, they too argue on the Shulchan Aruch. But, you know, they count because they got on the page of the Shulchan Aruch. You know, later than that, you can't argue anymore because, you know, you're just being a moron.
Didn't he
openly question Unkos? Unkos wasn't considered the status of a Tana. He lived as a Tana of Tanoim, but he wasn't a Tana.
Is he smart?
I think so. But there's a story, you know, that Rabbi Soloveitchik from Boston, YU, is a tremendous genius, and was once talking to Saul Lieberman. Saul Lieberman was a Frum Jew who was also a tremendous genius, but he became the leader of the conservative conservative smicha program at Jewish Theological Seminary. But he remained a Frum Jew, and he was very learned, very scholarly. So once Saul Lieberman was showing Tony Rabbi Soloveitchik about some tremendously strange shita approach, opinion they found one of the Gaonim. One of the isolated Gaonim, obscure Gaonim. So the Rabbi Soloveitchik said to Rabbi Lieberman, he said, the Zeta, his grandfather, meaning Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim Briska, he could learn better than many of the Gaonim. Right? So he's saying that his grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker, who lived, died in 1919, he was more knowledgeable than many of the minor Gaonim at the time of the Gaonim. Now, I wouldn't say such a thing, but not everybody who lived at the time of the Rishon was a Rishon. There were morons back then, too. I know it might seem remarkable that there were, but there were stupid people at the time of the Rishon.
I just don't understand how to reconcile this going back what we talked about with the calendar, the discussion of the calendar. And we talked, you mentioned Rav Schwab's opinion. Not Rav Schwab here for the people who are kids, but Rav Schwab's opinion. And, you know, you said a problem with that opinion, in your eyes, was the fact that it discredited the Chazal. So how is that, with using that same logic, how is that different there than it is here? The same, you're discrediting Chazal.
Who discredited the Chazal?
We're just skipping over their opinions, and they come before you.
What do you mean, skipping over?
I'm just saying, if the rug cover skips...
It's not to say Chazal. Chazal is a specific body of the sages. Chazal ends in the year 500.
Oh, okay. So Chazal, that had definition.
Yeah, Chazal. Chazal does not mean all great sages who ever lived.
Oh, okay.
When we use the term Chazal, we mean Tanoim Amoroim.
Oh, okay.
Okay, after that, even though we use the word Chazal, does not apply. Then you say, Rishonim, Achronim.
But today people use Chazal.
No!
Then
they're misusing it.
Have you ever heard people misuse it? Or
have I? Not that I've noticed. Not that I've noticed, but maybe
okay.
If I hadn't, if I went back.
Never knew the correct definition.
Yeah, that's the problem when people don't, you know, people use terms and they never explain them.
Right.
So, but that's a Chazal. Chazal always means Chazal or Razal. Sometimes it's Chazal, Chachameinu Zichronam Livracha. Sometimes it's Razal, Rabboseinu Zichronam Livracha. Same thing, it's only sages from the period of the Tanoim and Amoraim.
Because they would say Chazal are sages, so I'm thinking anyone who's been a rabbi, you know, from...
No. Besides, certainly being a rabbi doesn't mean anything. Okay, let's make that clear, right? We know...
We're all rabbis.
We know, yeah, everybody can be... Any Tom, Dick, and Harry can be a rabbi. It doesn't mean anything, right? Yeah.
We're making angels.
Why does it appear
that we make angels? We're angel makers, right?
Yeah.
That's what our occupation is. Angel makers.
What?
Why was there cut off here after your 500?
Because there was an agreement, understanding reached that this is the end of the period of that great genius and Santa Monica.
When was that agreement reached?
It was not an explicit agreement. But it's mentioned in the Gemara. It says, Ravina and Rav Ashi stole Torah. Somebody put it in a sin, obviously, after the time Ravina and Rav Ashi, who were last time were running. Right? Because they didn't write about themselves, okay, we're the end. That would not be proper. So somebody puts it in later on. We know the Gemara has additions from the next few generations. Not everything in the Gemara is from the time of the Amoraim. Did you know that?
No.
There was a period, a very mysterious period, after the period of the Amoraim called the period of Rabbanan Saburoi. Rabbanan Saburoi means literally the rabbis who explained. And they're a buffer zone between the end of the Talmud and the beginning of the Gaonim. And they actually explain things in the Gemara and put in passages in the Gemara. So their Gemara is not purely Amoraic material. It's material for Rabbanan Saburoi. I should tell you, you want me to tell you, let me tell you something about Apikorsus. Are you ready for some apikorsus?
Sure.
Anybody here know what apikorsus means? Heresy. Okay, I'm about to tell you some heresy. There is a new approach to learning Gemara, which is has become popular in the last few years, which is a heretical approach to learning Gemara. It's practiced in a few actual institutions which assert that they are orthodox, but they certainly don't fit in my book in terms of how they teach Talmud, and they hold that this period of Rabbanan Saburoi was really a period in which the Gemara was primarily written, and that there is a whole layer in the Gemara called Stama de Gemara, and they even made up a term called Stamoim, you know, Stanoim, Amoroim, Stamoim, and that's the discussion in the Gemara from their perspective, which doesn't have any name attached to it. You know, question, answer, resolution, you know, different centers. That's a lot. So they said the Stama of the Gemara, they weren't necessarily too bright. Right? They were just the editors. So therefore, they could have made mistakes in understanding the actual attributed material. They could have made mistakes. We can maybe understand Abaye better than the Stama of the Gemara understood Abaye. Because we, you know, they weren't too bright. And I guess that's why they didn't get their names attached to it. And we could be theoretically much brighter. So therefore, this leaves you... What?
Because I have a name.
Yeah. So that if you take that, that leads to all sorts of potential abuse. Because you can say, well, this interpretation of Abaye was the stomach of the Gemara's interpretation. That's Stamoi, right? that Stama guy, but I'm better than that Stama guy, and therefore I'm going to give my interpretation. That way it comes out very convenient, because I don't argue on the Moraim. No! Chas v'sholom! I don't argue on the Moraim. I only argue on Stamaim. So, that is a very prevalent and dangerous approach.
There's someone who pioneered that?
Yes.
Can you
David Weiss Halivni.
Where?
Did he put in here yet?
No, because he saw in JTS over many years, so nobody bothered. But it seeped into orthodoxy, because he himself also is an observant Jew, and he had students who became more observant, and that seeped into orthodox places.
That's
JTS. JTS.
So he did something bad?
Seminary.
So
what?
He did something bad?
He do something bad? Yeah, he made up this whole approach to Gemara, which is a bad approach.
Do we learn it here?
His approach? No, we don't.
Okay, so we don't need to know.
Well, I know you don't need to know, but it's fun to know these things. It's called, I'll tell you what it's called. In Israel, made a big, a lot of argument about it, because there are certain people who push it very, very strongly. It's called Shitat HaRevadim, the approach of layers. Because you peel back the layers of the Gemara, so to speak, to get at what's authentic and what's not authentic. Mm-hmm. And that's so Rivadim is the name of that approach.
Where is this yeshiva being taught?
In Babylon University. In Male Yeshiva.
Would you learn it, Rabbi?
No. In Yeshivat HaKibbutz HaDati, and in Yeshiva in America, in Yeshivat Kol Vei Torah.
What does Rabbi Ovadia Yosef say about this?
He probably says it's a terrible thing and should never be practiced, and people who do it are going to hell. That's what I would guess.
That sounds like it. You'll probably give him slaps, huh?
Yeah. Yes.
So the Shemayim comes.
He only slaps people he likes.
Like me.
Do you slap you?
Maybe. In my dreams.
Yeah.
The Shemayim come, according to them, after Amorayim?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Before them.
Yeah. Okay. The people we call Rabban Savaroi, they call Stamoim, and they, you know, they expand their role.
We say that whenever the Gemara doesn't say any name, it's Rabban Savaroi?
No. We say usually it's the...
period.
It's the Rabbina Rabban, the last period, the period of the editing of the shot, which begins already in the lifetime of Rabbina Ravashi, of course, because they're the ones who began editing. And it went on for, you know, I don't know, decades, how many, but it went on for several decades.
Rabban Savaroi or something else
there. But they're a very brief period.
And that sometimes comes up in the
Gemara. For example, anybody here ever learned Kiddushin, the beginning of Kiddushin?
Yeah.
So the entire first sugya of Ketef Minolon, right? That's Rabban Savaroi.
Well, what does that mean?
It means it's not part of the original Gemara. It was put in later on by the Rabban Savaroi. It's true.
Okay, there you go.
Okay? So...
I spent so much time on that, Rabbi. I don't even. Okay, I went to ninth grade, you learned the whole year, Rabbi. Head to toe, arms and knees and throat.
I'm glad. It's fine. It's good. It's good stuff.
Maybe I get married this
year. Now the that's connected. Fine. Now within the period of the Amoraim, the first Amoraim were the students of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, who finished the Mishnah, right? He finished the Mishnah. His students were the first Amoraim. The last Amoraim were the students of Ravina and Ravashi, and they're also the Rabbeim, the teachers of Rabban Savaroi. Okay, so Ravina and Ravashi were the ones who began the process of editing the Gemara. They did not complete it. It was completed afterwards, but they're mostly by their students. Within the generation of Amoraim, we have three or four generations in Israel, and seven generations in Babel. Because again, in Israel, the whole thing was curtailed relatively early. Now, one of the things about Israel, which is very important to know, is that until about the year 400 or so, give or take 50 years, they had real smicha. And that's why the rabbis in the Talmud Yerushalmi are mostly called, Rabbi. Because Rabbi was the title given to people at Yerush Micha. The Amoraim in Babel are called Rab, because they didn't have Yerush Micha. So that's the difference. With the Yud or without the Yud, it's the difference. There are a couple of rabbis who came from Babel to Eretz Yisrael, and also did not achieve the status of Shmicha, the one which went back to Moshe Rabbeinu, and there's one who's Rabbi Chanina ben Chachinoy, I think his name was called Chavrei the Rabbanim, wherever he's met, is called the Rabbi's friend, because in the Yerushalmi, because like he came from Babel to Eretz Yisrael, okay, and they didn't give him smicha, so they said, okay, we'll call my friend. Okay, so that's how they address him.
What does Rav mean?
Rav also means Rabbi.
Reb
means nothing. Reb just means it's like Mister in Yiddish.
Hmm.
Okay.
How about so Harav Yosef?
That's Rav, right? Harav means the Rabbi.
He doesn't have real smicha.
Nobody has real smicha nowadays. Stop in the year 425.
Who gave the smicha?
Who gave which smicha?
Any smicha.
Nowadays?
No, 1405.
No, it came directly down from Moshe Rabbeinu, from generation to generation.
Their rabbi would give their son the smicha?
Right, so on and so forth. Yeah. That's the smicha which you need in order to sit in a Sanhedrin, right, in a high court, in order to judge matters of life and death, in order to judge matters of all sorts of different penalties of all different sorts. That level of smicha was also required, and this is the main point, to make the Jewish calendar. Without that, you couldn't make a Jewish calendar. So this created a tremendous problem, because they foresaw that smicha would be nullified, and who's going to make the Jewish calendar from there on in? Right? If you need to have a Jewish calendar made, and you don't have the real smicha, so who's going to make the calendar? So that, not Harold Zucker, Harold Shane. So that the tradition has it that the primary tenets of the calendar, although I don't think the entire calendar is a cylindrical system, but most of them were put into place by the last Amora to have real smicha. And his name was Hillel. He was a great, either grandson or great-grandson of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who was the author of the Mishnah. So depending on whether he was the third or fourth grandson, great grandson, you'd have three or four generations of Amoraim in the land of Israel. And he, according to the Ramban, the Ramban has a slightly different interpretation, according to the Ramban, he prospectively, meaning looking ahead, set the calendar and gave it authenticity for all time to come. That's what he did. So according to the Ramban, Anytime you make a calendar, we're relying on the last person to have smicha and his court, Hillel HaSheni.
You can end it again because...
Also persecutions. Byzantine persecutions in this case.
Could we have technology also?
Right?
Could we have technology?
No, well, of course, nowadays when they make a calendar, they make it with technology. But that's because we don't have witnesses anymore. But till that time, they always just used witnesses in order to make the calendar. So now we just feed all the information to the computer program. It spits back the set calendar. But back then, you know, before the Hill of the Second, everything was done based on live witnesses. Yeah.
I was reading because I just wanted to go, and you said that there's 793 parts out of 1,080. And now that's at the end of the
mod.
Yeah.
So no.
That ends up to about 43 minutes and
30
seconds.
Right, 35 minutes, I think.
Oh, yeah, but it drives. I checked on NASA's website, and the discrepancy is about 30 seconds, but if you multiply that by the amount of months we've had in the air,
it's a problem.
That's a pretty big
problem. It is a major problem. It's a major problem, but it won't be of significant proportion, significant halakhically. Dramatically, significantly, problem until the year 42,000.
Oh.
And at which point we're going to have to adjust the calendar.
I'm looking forward to that.
What?
Looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Why will it be significant then?
Because all those seconds, because at that point we might start having Pesach in the wrong season and things like that.
Oh, but 40,000 the Hebrew calendar or on the Gregorian calendar?
Hebrew calendar.
Wait, that's the real number? You just made that up?
No, it's a real number.
42,000.
Yeah.
We're
going to
leave
us
with 6,000.
What?
Right.
We're not rats, we're not worried about it.
6,000
yeah.
Another 300 years.
The real problem, it would have been a major problem had we not switched over from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar. Because the non-Jewish world used to be on the Julian calendar. the Julian calendar was the solar calendar devised by the Roman sages at the time of Julius Caesar. And in 1582, Pope Gregory introduced the Gregorian calendar, because the Julian calendar is based on the assumption that every year is exactly 365 1/4 days long, and that doesn't work out. It's not true. It's actually so much shorter. So the Julian calendar is constantly getting ahead of where it should be. So, for example, the discrepancy between the Julian and Gregorian calendar today is 14 days. Now, this comes out, this actually affects halacha. I've told some of you in the past that this is the greatest difficulty I have with Judaism. Nobody's heard that from me?
I heard from a friend about the subject, the fact that the
Talmud. Yeah. This is my greatest crisis of faith in Judaism, is that we say the same, when did we start saying the same Talmud in Chutzlaret? December 5th. Have you ever wondered where we came up with that wacky number from? What? So it's 60 days after the equinox, because that's when it's true winter. The problem is, what day is the equinox?
September
21st. 20th, 21st, right? So when should we start saying the same time of Malta?
Late December?
November 21st. 2 months after September 21st. But for the same time of Malta, we're still following the Julian calendar. And the Julian equinox is now 14 days after the Gregorian equinox. So therefore, we're saying the same amount of Talmud based on the Julian calendar, which is by, at this point, totally wrong. So now you got, according to the Julian calendar, it's also already happened that Pesach comes out in the winter. Because if you take a true Julian calendar, that means spring doesn't start for 14 days until after we actually start spring. I mean, it doesn't start March 21st, it starts April, whatever. So if that's the case, April 4th. So if that's the case, you actually have Pesach sometimes at the beginning of the winter, and that's not permissible. The only way it remains... Pesach is Chag
Rabim. No, say the whole thing. Why is Pesach too early?
Because sometimes Pesach comes out at the end of March, or the very beginning of April.
Yeah.
And according to the Julian calendar, that's still winter, right? Because the Julian calendar...
Which calendar is that? The one we used to...
The old one, right. The one, St. Thomas calendar.
Why is that?
Because they are off by 14 days.
Why is that a problem today? Do they want a Gregorian calendar?
Sorry?
Yes,
but the thing is that at the same time also we're still running according to the Julian calendar.
We're not the only ones in the world still using the Julian calendar.
Right, so the Russian Orthodox. Yay! That's the Greek Orthodox.
We're saying the same time also 2 weeks late.
What?
Why the
because you make very peach mud essay if they didn't say according to the Julian calendar.
Rockers
of Atala.
There are bigger issues that I've had with...
You've had bigger issues with Judaism?
Probably.
Like what?
I can't
even talk about it.
I'll come up with some, I'm sure.
What did the Gregorian calendar do to adjust to the Julian calendar? How did it do? Well, I'm saying, what did it do to adjust?
It takes off the leap every...
That's why we have a leap year?
No, that's the leap year is in the Julian calendar. The Gregorian calendar has that every year which ends with a zero, which would have been a leap year, you don't make a leap year. Okay, so that's how they compensate.
But 2001 leap year?
How come we haven't changed that?
2001 wasn't a leap year.
I know.
As in February?
It's 17th,
right?
Leap year as in what?
As in February 29th. Yeah.
Why don't we change it?
16.
Why don't we? I don't know. It should be called that. It shouldn't stay or saying.
That's my big problem.
Well, yeah, you gotta start a campaign.
Obviously, I'm not gonna start a campaign, but people are gonna think I'm out of my mind.
You're right, though. If you explain it like that, how can anyone ever doubt that?
You see, it's the biggest crisis of faith too.
Well, it's crazy. Yeah.
Told it.
Ask Rabbi Braun. What is this?
The idea is like this. It's all since it's. Really, chutzpah is all custom because in Eretz Yisrael is the main place where
that's
the terrain. They say much earlier anyway, right? They start saying the same thing Mozart in 2 weeks.
I thought all the times were done from Babel, though.
What?
I thought all the timing, though, was done from Babel, not from this itself.
It's the same climate. They need rain at the same time.
Okay.
So therefore, everything else doesn't count anyway. Now, and the proof of that is that they say the same time of Mozart in the southern hemisphere, according to the same pattern as the northern hemisphere. But they needed the exact opposite time of the year, right?
Right.
We needed they needed an hour summer, which is their winter.
Right.
But everything follows the Eretz Yisrael anyway, so therefore we don't care that much about Chutz Laaretz. That's the idea. By the way, you know the Chassidim, they don't learn the Christmas Eve, right? Because it's considered to be, they don't learn Torah Christmas Eve.
Why?
Because it's considered to be for reasons I don't understand. That it's considered to give power to the forces of evil if you learn Torah Christmas Eve.
How can we learn Torah Christmas
Eve? What?
It's
Chanukah.
So there's a bigger issue.
What? Anyway, it doesn't
how
matter.
How can we learn Torah give power to the forces of evil?
You're asking me.
There's a bigger issue right there.
Okay. So, well, I'm not a Chassid, so I don't have that issue.
That
is it. So the most Chassidim follow the Julian calendar for that. But they don't do December trade. So the ones that are very machmir do two nights a year. But they don't follow December 25th, they follow the Greek Orthodox Christmas with it 2 weeks later.
Wait, so they don't study for 2 days in January?
It's only the ninth. It's only Christmas Eve from nightfall to midnight.
So they don't study Torah on the night that the Greek Orthodox celebrate Christmas.
Why?
But don't they realize that all the Greek Orthodox people are in a different part of the world anyway? They have
that. Doesn't matter. The Tumah pervades the world.
Okay.
Rabbi, isn't it the opposite? You have to study more Torah to go against it?
I would think so. You can't get. You won't get an explanation from me because I don't understand.
That's good as a Satmar place.
Yes, go to the Satmar place, a vision place in Athens.
Yeah.
Good luck, man.
I won't have my son.
Over 1900 years, the difference in the Noah will be about eight days in 1900 years.
Yeah, so it doesn't matter until Pesach starts coming out in the winter or in the summer. Right? As long as Pesach is in the spring and Sukkot is in the fall, so we're okay.
Yeah.
Is there any problem with the time that we say the same time as in Israel?
No.
There isn't.
No, it works out perfectly, as a matter of fact, because it's right after Sukkot. You know, every year it's slightly different, but Sukkot is the time when the rainy season begins. And we really, would start earlier from Sukkot itself, but at the times when they went on pilgrimage to, you know, so they needed time to get home before the rain, they would want the rains to start.
We don't say
yeah, that's the whole shaila. If you travel to Israel, in that period between the time we start saying the same time Mata in Israel and the period you start saying the same time Mata Chutz Laaretz, what do you do? How do you ask? Big question.
Is it possible to get a seat today without a Sanhedrin?
No.
So
yes, we could if everybody would agree.
Yeah,
I'd
likely.
You know what would be really cool? If someone changed and the other started throwing stones at us to say the same time Mata at the wrong time.
Rabbi, can we change to Gemara if we're smarter than us?
Yeah, but you're not, so therefore...
Huh?
You can't.
Why not?
Because the Rambam says that once there's universal acceptance of the Gemara, nothing can ever change that.
How about if I make a universal and another new universal acceptance?
You can only add on to the Gemara. You can't detract anything from the Gemara.
Why?
Because once there's universal acceptance, that already becomes embedded in the halachic reality. You can just add on, you can't take away.
Rabbi, you just made me think of 500 other questions.
500?
I'm telling you.
Oh, well, I'm back again tomorrow night at 10:45, so. Yeah.
So Hillel set the calendar, and at that point, they no longer had Adim come.
Right.
But there's still 2 months that could be monitored or something.
Right, but that's also done by reckoning. There is a formula for that.
One question. If Pesach was going to fall out in the winter, so why don't we just add an Adar?
Nowadays?
It would happen in 36,000 years.
Yeah, but we don't have real smicha to add an Adar anymore.
Okay, but if I knew it was going to happen, it's in the middle of the race, then I have Pesach in the winter. What choice do I have?
You're right. There's going to be a problem. When it comes up, we'll deal with it. In the meantime, I want to tell you some other, which is that the Rambam Shita about calendars is different and fascinating. The Rambam says the Kila Sheni whoever it was said the time by buying Rava, which is the time of the Shane, somebody put the calendar's principles down on paper. And from then on, we can reckon the calendar. But it only works, he says, if there are 10 Jews living in the land of Israel. Were it ever to be possible that the land of Israel would not even have 10 Jews living there, the whole calendar would collapse.
Why would that be?
Because he says, those 10 Jews represent our Klal Yisrael.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's not that Hillel that did for all years, right? It's that the Sanhedrin acts on behalf of Klal Yisrael. So if there's no Sanhedrin, it's Klal Yisrael. So, but if there's no Klal Yisrael, there's no calendar. And there's no Klal Yisrael if there aren't 10 Jews in Chutzlaret. There could be 500 million Jews in Chutzlaret. If there aren't 10 Jews in Eretz Yisrael, there's no Klal Yisrael.
Roshiach will come.
What do you mean the calendar
falls?
What does that mean?
We couldn't keep any Yom Tov. Shabbat we still have. We couldn't keep any Yom
Tov. So what is...
The Rambam says it's never going to happen.
Oh.
It only says it's
theoretically possible. So that, if it actually happened, what would be?
You'd have Shabbat.
You
would have Shabbat. I think... No, you'd have Shabbat.
Oh, you still have Shabbat.
Yeah, I think the Jewish people would survive just fine. Judaism would cost a lot less.
No,
think about it.
Come on.
It's a cheaper religion than we did.
That
was...
big plan.
Yeah. So, wouldn't be as exciting, but it wouldn't be as expensive. Okay, any other questions? Otherwise, we'll be back tomorrow night, 7:45.
Rabbi, if everyone believes in one rabbi, then do you have to believe in that rabbi too?
Is there anybody like
that? Like, the universal acceptance of...
Is there any universal acceptance of anybody? Judaism is... Judaism is based on the assumption that there always are going to be multiple views. God put that into the fabric of Judaism. Beginning with the 12 tribes, right? There's no... God doesn't want all Jews necessarily to agree on the same thing.
How about the rabbis come and do mystical things in front of our eyes? He's real.
Then what? So what? So that's nice, you can do mystical things, and now what?
In front of you. So he can say that I have no will for my shame. Everyone, I can be the apostle.
Yeah, that we won't believe him because of that. That can do mystical things, doesn't matter.
He said he has Nebuah.
So what?
So you don't believe someone has Nebuah?
Unless he can predict the future.
And if he does predict the future...
then we shall worry about it.
What do you mean by predict the future?
He has to say, tomorrow, you are going to slip on a banana peel. I'm exaggerating, right? But that's too simple, because he could fix that. Right? That's something which he can't fix. He can't make it happen.
With the rain.
Right, like rain. Yeah. It's going to rain in 3 weeks. Right? This type of day,
just
rain.
Can't the psychics do that, Rabbi? They call them the spirits of the earth. No one can see that, Rabbi. Excuse me, there's the Weather Channel.
Yeah, the Weather Channel. Okay, guys, have a good evening.
You can get a 2-week forecast on AccuWeather.
But it's not reliable past the first couple of days, right?
Yeah, for a couple of hours. Only in the West Coast, Rabbi.
But you
should
have made him
laugh.
You're just by
putting
adding one
answer.
You're from
LA? No, whatever. Now he's asking me another of my questions.
Another of
my doubts that I had.
Look, that's the smile that you came tonight then.
I tried to
Yeah, like nobody keeps track of anything,
yeah.
So
we trust you're not going to.
Look, if it lets you into the yeshiva, I think that's okay with you.
I'm not paying for that. No. What's your name again?